My name is Michael Dimino. I'm a member of the Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group. It has been my pleasure to be associated with the Federalist Society and the practice groups, in part because we helped to organize wonderful panels such as this one, although I had no role in organizing this particular panel. That honor and our thanks go to our moderator, who it is my job to introduce. The title of the panel, Physician, Heal Thyself, many of you will recognize, comes from the Bible. It's Luke chapter 4. I think we can all be thankful that Jesus wasn't referring to attorneys when he made the statement about doctors. I think if he was, it would have been lawyer sue you. Our moderator is Texas Supreme Court Justice Brett Busby. He was appointed to the court in 2019 by Governor Abbott, and the following year won election to that court. He is a graduate of Duke and the Columbia Law School. He has clerked on the 11th Circuit and the United States Supreme Court for Justices Stevens and White. He was a successful appellate litigator in Houston and a judge on Texas's 14th Circuit Court of Appeals. He's also an adjunct at the University of Texas Law School and now has been a five-year veteran of the Texas Supreme Court. Everyone, please welcome Justice Busby.
Well, thank you, Professor, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I want to thank the Federalist Society for the opportunity to bring these distinguished experts together to talk to you this morning. It's a real honor for me to have a chance, as a many-year attendee of this convention, to have a chance to visit with you this morning. Of course, for those of you who had a chance to come to the dinner on Thursday night, you already heard a wonderful introduction to our panel from Justices Gorsuch and Breyer about the importance of regulatory reform. And we lawyers have made a cottage industry of reforming the regulation of other industries. And so it's time this morning to turn the microscope on our own profession. So let's start with who are the regulators? And usually the answer to that of the regulators of the legal profession are the state Supreme Courts. Many courts around the country have expressed separation of powers provisions in their constitution and within the sphere of the judicial power is the regulation of the legal profession. In many states, that power is aided by mandatory bar associations, and in some states, state legislatures have a role as well to play in regulating the legal profession. The American Bar Association has also carved out a big role for itself. It's the source of ethical rules that are adopted in many states that profoundly influence the structure of the profession. And also, as you heard on an excellent panel, if you had a chance to attend earlier in the convention, has accreditation rules that profoundly affect the form and content of legal education. So is all this as it should be, a sort of modern guild system for a self-regulating profession? Or is the fox guarding the hen house, or you might say access to the courthouse? Beginning in the early 20th century, state Supreme Courts and legislatures chose to give licensed attorneys a monopoly on practicing law and funding law firms and switched to law schools rather than apprenticeships as the main path to licensure. Now, this is not a natural monopoly. It's an artificial or a regulatory monopoly. And, of course, there are good reasons why we would want to have these types of licensure requirements. I think we can all agree that we want attorneys who are both competent and ethical. But have we gone too far with regulations that don't sufficiently further these goals or do so at too high a cost? Well, let's look at the results. The predictable economic consequence of artificial scarcity of supply, of course, is that lawyers charge monopoly rents, part of which are transferred to law schools to pay off the increasingly enormous cost of legal education. And then there's also substantial unmet demand for legal services. The profession does a lot to help, and we're very grateful for that, including pro bono work and legal aid funding, but that meets only the barest fraction of this need. Ms. Ricca will talk about more of the statistics as part of her presentation, but just to give you one, a recent study was that over 90% of the basic civil legal needs of low-income Americans are still not being met. And surely Americans of all income levels would prefer to pay a lower price for simple legal services. quote Judge Rao's remarks yesterday, these sorts of barriers impose costs on the economy, stifle innovation, and generally make Americans less well off. But more than that, the staggering scale of the unmet demand is damaging the faith of Americans in our justice system and the rule of law itself, which surveys show is at an all-time low. So with these alarms sounding, several states have responded by implementing or studying structural changes to increase the supply and drive down the cost of legal services while still ensuring competence and protecting ethics in the profession. Some of these efforts have met with stiff resistance from the organized bar. We've assembled a distinguished panel of legal regulators and other experts to speak to you today, and our goal is to help equip you to raise this issue in your states by discussing the pros and cons of three regulatory changes. First, licensing legal paraprofessionals to perform limited legal services directly for clients. You can think of this as the legal equivalent of a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant. Second, allowing non-lawyers to invest in providers of legal services to help increase supply. And third, reforming legal education and licensure to increase the supply of lawyers, especially in underserved geographic and practice areas. In Texas, we're moving forward on the first change and exploring the other two. In August, my court issued for public comment proposed rules that would license paraprofessionals who meet certain experience requirements and pass an examination to perform limited legal services for low-income Texans in certain areas of family law, probate law, consumer debt law, and landlord-tenant law. Those are the areas where we see the most self-represented people showing up in our court system. So now it's my pleasure to introduce each of our panelists briefly, and each of them will have a chance to give you some opening comments. I have a few questions for them. We'll have a dialogue with the panel, and then we welcome your participation and questions as well. So I'll start next to me and in the order in which they will speak. Our first speaker will be Lucy Buford Ricca, the Executive Director of the Rohde Center on Law and the Legal Profession at Stanford Law School. She's a national expert in efforts to reform regulation of the legal profession to increase innovation, market diversification, and access to justice. She served as the first Executive Director of the Utah Office of Legal Services Innovation, a regulator of legal services launched by the Utah Supreme Court. Next to her is Justice Clint Bolick, who's served on the Supreme Court of Arizona since 2016 and was retained earlier this month for another six-year term. So congratulations, Justice Bolick. Arizona has been an innovator on all three of the issues that I mentioned. Before taking the bench, Justice Bolick was a prominent litigator who served as the Vice President of Litigation at the Goldwater Institute and co-founder and Vice President of Litigation at the Institute for Justice. He's an adjunct professor at both Arizona State University and the University of Arizona Law Schools. Our next speaker is Justice Charles Kennedy of the Florida Supreme Court, who served there since 2008 and served three terms as that court's Chief Justice. He has also served four terms in the United States House of Representatives and on that body's Judiciary Committee, three terms in the Florida House, and as a justice on Florida's Intermediate Court of Appeals. Florida has considered some of these innovations and decided not to move forward at this time, and we look forward to Justice Kennedy's thoughts about that process. And our last but certainly not least speaker is Danielle Hirsch, who's Managing Director of Court Consulting Services with the National Center for State Courts. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the National Center, I urge you to take a look at their website and the wonderful work that they do. This is the body that works with the Conference of Chief Justices of all of our state Supreme Courts and looks at the policies and work that those chief justices have set as their agenda. And one of in that capacity, she's helping to lead, among other initiatives, their Committee on Legal Education and Admissions Reform, or CLEAR, which is about focusing on issues of increasing lawyer supply, including in legal deserts and underserved practice areas. Ms. Hirsch is the former executive director of the Illinois Access to Justice Commission and assistant director of the Civil Justice Division of the Administrative Office of Illinois Courts. And finally, our last panelist today was going to be Justice Jay Mitchell from the Supreme Court of Alabama, and Justice Mitchell regrets that he's fallen ill and wasn't able to join us today, but I will mention a few of the comments later in the program that he would have given us, and we wish him well and a speedy recovery. He's going to be fine, but wasn't able to be with us today. Last, before I turn it over to the panel, I want to thank the Federalist Society Regulatory Transparency Project for their work on this issue. They released a wonderful paper on this topic last year called The World Needs More Lawyers. And then they had a program in April of this year that you can find online on legal licensing reform, hearing from a lot of other experts on this topic. So I urge you, if you're interested, to take a look at those resources. And there are also a lot of papers that will that are in the materials, the CLE materials for this panel that will help further inform you on the topics that we're going to talk about today. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Ricca to start us off.
Thank you. Thank you, Justice Busby, and thank you. I'm very honored to be invited here to speak with you all today. So I'm going to put a little bit of context around the reforms that Justice Busby touched on and speak a little bit about what is happening across different states currently. So efforts to rethink the regulation of legal services is driven primarily by the recognition that our legal services market is dysfunctional. It is not working for most American consumers. What does that mean? Most Americans either cannot or do not get legal help for the problems that they face in their daily lives. A 2020 study from the Institute for the Advancement of the American Legal System at the University of Denver estimated that there are 250 million legal problems faced by Americans annually, 120 million of which go unresolved. This has serious impacts on the courts, particularly state courts, which handle 98% of civil cases. In 75% of those cases, at least one party is without a lawyer. In some areas, such as family, housing, debt, 80 to 90% of parties are unrepresented. So in a system that was built on an adversarial model with qualified representatives kind of going at it, we don't have that actual in reality in state courts anymore. But what we see in the courts is actually the tip of the iceberg. Many, many issues that people face in their daily lives never make it to law or to court. We're talking about most people in this country, our family, our friends, our colleagues, our teachers, our first respondents, civil servants, small business owners, dealing with family issues, contract breaches, education issues, neighbor disputes, financial security, housing. Our profession is not serving these people and these small businesses, and that gap is impacting people's faith in our justice system, in the profession, and in our democracy. The key message here is that the status quo right now, the current state of the legal services market, is causing a great deal of harm every day, day after day, week after week, year after year, to individual citizens, communities, and our country. The traditional approaches to addressing the access to justice crisis, like increasing the overall number of lawyers or mandating pro bono service, have proven ineffective. The number of lawyers has increased in both absolute terms and proportional to the American population almost fourfold since the 1970s, and yet the number of unrepresented people continued to rise. And while many lawyers are dedicated to pro bono work, only a small portion of hours across the profession are actually committed to it. There are many contributing factors to the justice gap, but there is clear scholarly consensus that the rules governing the provision of legal services play a key role in undermining the functioning of the market and creating the resulting justice gap. These rules entrench a concept of a market in which lawyers are the only providers of legal services, but that just does not reflect modern reality and, in fact, now undermines the ability of our profession and the market to modernize and serve the people it needs to serve. In particular, the ban on the unauthorized practice of law, which exists across all 50 states in rule or statute, says that only lawyers can practice law with a broadly sweeping definition of what the practice of law is, including simple legal advice and help just completing court-issued forms. This sharply limits the development of alternative forms of assistance, whether through non-lawyer providers or technology. Second, Rule 5.4, which states that only lawyers may own or manage legal practices, and lawyers and law firms may not tap forms of capital apart from their own profits or ordinary loans secured by those profits. Nor can lawyers or law firms offer equity interests to other types of professionals, whether technologists or business specialists, in order to drive innovation. Lawyers cannot work as salaried employees of corporations and offer their legal services to the public. What I've just described are all modern forms of business and capital structuring, incentivizing, and employment from which we have removed and walled off our entire profession. The unauthorized practice of law ban and Rule 5.4 operate as economic restrictions on the legal services market, limiting not only who or what may provide services, but also how those services may be financed and structured. So, if we reduce those restrictions and allow more forms of legal services to develop and more capital to flow into the sector, new structures and models for producing and delivering legal services, we should see decreasing cost and increasing access for regular people and small businesses. I'm going to talk about two main threats here. I'm going to leave legal education to Danielle, but I'm going to talk specifically about regulatory So there are two kind of key approaches that are being taken, as Justice Busby touched on. One is allowing more individuals to provide legal services, and this is reforming the unauthorized practice of law restriction to create more legal services roles. The reform that is has sort of gained the most traction in this space is the licensing of independent paraprofessionals. The theory here is that there's multiple legal service activities that are more routinized, repetitive, simple, in particular legal service areas, for which you don't need fully qualified lawyers. We can authorize and oversee providers in a similar way to what we do with lawyers. Qualification requirements like education and testing, professional conduct rules, inserting them into the disciplinary process. And then these folks can provide less expensive services in areas of particular consumer need, really hitting that middle class part of the gap, which is a really significant proportion of folks unable to access the services of lawyers. So there are a lot of states moving forward on this particular reform: Washington, Oregon, Colorado, New Hampshire, Minnesota, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, to name a few, and more exploring it. Another approach is to allow new organizations or entities to provide direct legal services to consumers and regulate those entities. The theory here is that entities or organizations can fund and provide legal services at scale and in a diversity of ways. And when we allow business and capital reform by allowing non-lawyer ownership, we still want to oversee the entity and ensure that these new forms of ownership and finances are upholding the professional values that we care about and ensuring that consumers are not being harmed. So that's why regulating the entity matters. The challenge here is that the regulation of organizations is quite different from regulating people. An organization can't really take a bar exam or pass a moral character requirement. So it requires at least some new regulatory effort and apparatus. Organizational reform, which can impact both Rule 5.4 and the unauthorized practice of law, is what has moved forward in Utah and Arizona. Both states now allow non-lawyer-owned firms or companies to provide legal services to the public. The two states have taken quite different approaches. Arizona followed the model that was developed in the United Kingdom a little bit more closely and eliminated Rule 5.4 entirely, but requires non-lawyer-owned legal businesses to be regulated. Only lawyers can practice law within those entities. Utah took a regulatory sandbox approach, and within that regulatory sandbox space allows entities both with non-lawyer ownership and using non-lawyer people and technology to provide legal practice activities that otherwise would have been banned under the unauthorized practice of law. So quite different reforms, and I can speak a little bit later about some of the different impacts that we've seen. This last thread of reform, the corporate practice of law, organizational provision of legal services, is extremely controversial. And I think part of the reason for that is that I think people have a hard time understanding how this type of reform could impact the justice gap. Why allowing new forms of financing and organizational service provision could make a difference for all the people who are unable to access legal services right now. And that's why our recent research at the Rody Center on the history of auto clubs, of all things, and the unauthorized practice of law, which you have in your reading, is quite helpful. The paper by my faculty director, Nora Friedman Engstrom, and our recent law school graduate, James Stone, looks back at the early history of auto clubs in the early 1900s, when auto clubs provided, and other organizations such as banks and title insurance companies, provided legal services through their lawyer staff to the public. Auto clubs, both for-profit and nonprofit, provided a lot of legal services to their members. Teams of auto club lawyers defended members charged with driving-related misdemeanors and felonies. They filed suits mirroring contemporary impact litigation to affect policy change, and they brought and defended thousands of civil claims for vehicle-related harm. The scale of the services that these clubs provided is quite amazing. The Chicago Motor Club, using 10 full-time attorneys and 65 sporadic contract attorneys, in 1931 handled over 8,500 civil claims. That's only the civil claims that they dealt with. And these were often very small claims, claims that probably then and certainly now no independent lawyer would take. But in the 1930s, with the profession under stress of the Great Depression, the organized bar associations began to prosecute auto clubs for the unauthorized practice of law, developing what was then a new theory that the corporate organization, whether for-profit or nonprofit, could not practice law, even through licensed lawyers. The paper goes into more detail on the legal theory, so I urge you to take a look. Quickly after that, club by club, the bar sued these legal departments essentially out of existence, despite no evidence whatsoever that any consumers were harmed by the legal services provided by the clubs, and actually, you know, quite a lot of interest on the part of consumers in these legal services. In fact, the motivation of the bar associations going after this thriving sector of the market was explicitly protectionist. Leaders across the country specifically stated that these lawsuits against the auto clubs were being driven by the goal of protecting lawyers from serious threats to their well-being. In one particularly memorable quote, a member of the ABA's Committee on the Unauthorized Practice said, "The bar needed to act lest the lawyer be driven from the banquet table at which for centuries he has had a distinguished place." So, by looking back, the paper helps us to see the possible if we move toward allowing organizations, corporate organizations, to provide legal services through both UPL and 5.4 reform. It also shows us the truly rotten roots of these entrenchment of these rules in our ethical code. Maybe I'll pause and circle back for other issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Ms. Ricca. Justice Bowling.
Thank you. It is such a pleasure to be here. I didn't arrive till last night, so I missed all of the fun. But I am grateful to the Federalist Society, not only for doing this, but also for scheduling this not on my wedding anniversary for the first time in a really long time. I may be persuasive in certain contexts, but trying to convince my wife this is the place to celebrate her anniversary simply doesn't work. Because I have so much to cram into 5 to 7 minutes, I have taken the unusual step of writing my remarks, because as someone who grew up in New Jersey, I can talk much faster than I can think, which is why people from New Jersey get into so much trouble. When I joined my court nearly 9 years ago, I had no idea how much we could accomplish through rulemaking and the regulation of the legal profession. I am so proud that Arizona leads the nation in deregulation of the legal profession. And in fact, we've adopted the trifecta of reforms that Justice Busby talked about and that Ms. Ricca described in greater detail. These are mainly depicted as access to justice reforms, and they surely are, but I view them as dragging the legal profession, kicking and screaming, into the 21st century. I hasten to add that although I enthusiastically supported these reforms, I did not lead them. That is a strategic lesson. You can count on your court's most libertarian justice to lead successful efforts in abolishing peremptory jury strikes or reforming no-knock warrants, which I have. But if that justice leads a deregulation effort, he or she will be suspected of nefarious designs. So enlist a less libertarian champion instead. And fortunately, we had an incredibly capable one and our current Chief Justice, Ann Timmer. Those of you who are as old as me and yet somehow also still breathing will remember how the financial services industry was once segmented and sheltered into commercial banks, savings and loans, stock brokerages, and the like, and none could do what the others did. Deregulation was proposed and fiercely resisted by financial institutions who predicted the sky would collapse. Today, we see a vibrant, innovative, interconnected, efficient, and consumer-friendly financial services industry with lots of economies of scale and one-stop shopping. That's what I talk about moving the legal profession into the 21st century. So too now in Arizona with the legal services industry. First, we proposed alternative business structures, which we call ABSs, that abolished Rule 54, the requirement of lawyer ownership. Wait, the big firms warned. What happens if the big five accounting firms move into Arizona and start offering legal services? Our response to that was, why don't you start offering accounting services and allow accountants to have an ownership in your firm? ABSs are regulated and have to be renewed every year to ensure that they comply with legal ethics rules. But among the 100 or so that we have approved so far, we have seen unbelievable dynamism in ways we never could have predicted and that only the market can produce. My favorite is a firm that both invests in patents and obtains them. If I had a patent, I would love for my lawyer to literally be invested in my success. And that's exactly what's happening. Second was the creation of a new profession, legal paraprofessionals. My only contribution to this was originally it was LLLPs. I can't even remember what the acronym was. And I'm like, if we call them that, they will die right on the vine. So we shortened it to legal paraprofessionals. Upon receiving training, either through practice or schooling, if they pass a specialized exam in their particular area, they can directly represent clients in court and in transactions. Before this reform, over half of our family law parties were unrepresented, and our Department of Child Services was severely understaffed. Now we will have specialized paraprofessionals to fill the void, offering services at a fraction of the cost of lawyers. Legal paraprofessionals are regulated like lawyers with the same ethical obligations and are required to be members of the state bar, but this latter only because I have not yet succeeded in providing that no one has to be a member of the state bar. I hope you're not clapping because I haven't succeeded. I hope we will see a confluence of these first two reforms, and this is exactly what's happening in the United Kingdom. When one day we can walk into a supermarket and find next door to a healthcare clinic where you are greeted by a nurse practitioner, a legal services clinic where you will be greeted by a legal paraprofessional. The most recent reform is one I hope will help solve a conundrum. When I joined the court, I was determined to end the protectionistic, largely job-unrelated bar examination. I have a massive notebook to that effect. But then, alarmingly, many law schools stopped teaching law. And that turned me into a reluctant defender of the nation's highest passing score on the bar examination, which Arizona has. I am cautiously optimistic that the next-gen bar exam will alleviate this conundrum by making this rite of passage more practical. In the interim, we changed our rules to allow applicants with scores no more than 10 points below the normal pass score to work in the public sector or in woefully underserved rural areas under the supervision of a practicing lawyer. If they do so successfully for 2 years, they become fully licensed. This at once helps us solve the problem of too few lawyers, words I thought I would never say, coupled with our insistence on high bar scores for admission. Or put another way, it promotes both quality and quantity. Our one final note for all of you. You too get to play. In our state, anyone can propose rules changes. This is an underutilized mechanism for legal reform. Please think innovatively. It is far more informal than the legislative process. Just be prepared, if you succeed, to be assigned to a task force to implement your idea. I love learning about untapped tools for regulatory reform. Let's put them to use. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Bullock. Justice Kennedy.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, even though I find myself in the somewhat uncomfortable position of being the skunk at the Reform Garden Party. But basically what I'm going to do is talk about our experience in Florida, basically of rejecting various reform proposals, and give you a little bit of the context for how that process worked and the basic reasons that we have not moved forward with these reforms that we've heard about, and the focus on particularly the structural reforms in the way the legal profession is organized. And I think that to kind of sum up where we have landed for now is that we are guided by the principle, first, do no harm, and the concern that we really didn't know, have a good understanding of the impacts of the reforms. I understand it's kind of a chicken and egg problem. You can't really know what the benefits of reform are going to be until you do reform. But we are hoping to learn from the experience of those who are on the vanguard of this, but we felt that we might find ourselves to be on the bleeding edge of some things that would be counterproductive. So that's, and again, I want to be clear here. It should be obvious. I don't speak for my court. I speak for myself only. But this is my perspective on our experience in Florida. Now, back in November of 2019, in the wake of the reforms in that were moving forward in Utah and Arizona, our court initiated an examination of reforms to improve the delivery of legal services through the formation of a special committee chaired by the then president of the Florida Bar. And we went at this pretty aggressively, and the special committee was formed, and the president of the Florida Bar, then the president of the Florida Bar, was our bar president served for just a year, was enthusiastic about it and chaired our committee. Then they went about their work. But the concern undergirding our establishment of the special committee was, as you could probably figure out from what you've already heard, the problem of inadequate access to legal services, especially for low and moderate income people. That's what we had in mind when we formed the committee. And our concern was to look at ways that we could help address that problem, which is obviously a serious problem, and which we recognize to be a serious problem. So the special committee's work went on until it produced a report that was submitted to the court in June of 2021. Now, I'm not going to go through the whole committee's report, but central to the recommendations of the committee was a law practice, what they referred to as a law practice innovation lab program, which is a mechanism similar to the regulatory sandbox adopted in Utah. Along with recommendations for allowing within the lab program certain non-lawyer employees of law firms to acquire minority ownership interests in the firms, and for eliminating restrictions on sharing fees with non-lawyers. And that was kind of the core of what they were recommending. They had other proposals, some related to the use of paralegals in certain practice areas within the lab program. Subsequently, this came to the court. When it came to our court, it also went to the Board of Governors of the Florida Bar. They did not review it in advance. It was coming to the court from the committee, but we expected on the court to receive input from the Board of Governors of the Florida Bar, obviously. And so it went to them, and they evaluated it, and they got a lot of comments. And in late December of 2021, they submitted their response to the proposals. Now, the Board of Governors received a great deal of negative input. It's not surprising, from lawyers and others within the state. At the end of their consideration, they rejected the key features of the report's recommendations related to the regulatory sandbox, non-lawyer ownership of interest in law firms, and fee sharing with non-lawyers. And they did so unanimously. It was not a discordant voice on the Board of Governors of the Florida Bar. Now, in short order, our court considered what they sent us. And, of course, we'd been looking at the report since we had received it back during the summer, but waiting for the Board of Governors to act. And ultimately, our court decided that we would not implement any of the recommendations of the special committee other than a technical change regarding nonprofit legal service providers. Now, we did ask, in connection with our rejection of the recommendations, that the Board of Governors give us some alternative recommendations to assist in improving access to legal services, because the problem's still there, and we recognize that, and the rejection of the recommendations is not a rejection of the premise for our exploring this, which is the need for increasing access to legal service. So that's an ongoing project. Of course, I will say this. We have been working on that and continue to work on that in a variety of ways. One of our major focuses is on providing resources to self-represented litigants. And we have devoted considerable resources, considerable time and energy to helping develop those resources. And I think that's very important. I think that one thing that has helped our access for certain self-represented litigants is the result of the pandemic and our use of platforms like Zoom. I think that decreases the burden on self-represented litigants. But that's part of the picture here. But those are things that we continue to work on and are a major focus in Florida. And among the resources, we have forms, but we also have developed video resources, tutorials, to help. And again, I know we're not unique in Florida in that. Other states have done likewise. The reason that we acted as we did, I think, are explained the two primary concerns underlying our reluctance to move forward on the basis of what was presented to us and what we know at the time, what we knew at the time it was presented to us. The first is that we do think that there's some, and when I say we, I mean that's the royal we. That's me, okay? Again, I'm not speaking for my court. There's a concern that there is real importance in maintaining the independence of the judgment of lawyers and the provision of legal services to their client. Of course, that's the ethical imperative codified in the ABA Model Rule 5.4, an analogous state rule provisions that has erected these barriers to financial arrangements that could erode or eliminate that independence of judgment. Now, I recognize that lawyers operating under those ethical imperatives are not indifferent to profit. I think we all recognize that lawyers are not indifferent to the profitability of their law practices. But the concern is, if you have people that are not subject to the ethical obligations of lawyers, and don't take that oath in the same way that lawyers do, to abide by their duties as lawyers, that you kind of create this conflict where the profit motive could interfere in the exercise of the lawyer's judgment in a way that goes beyond just what human nature might interfere with the people carrying out their duties when they see the opportunity to make a dollar. That's kind of the underlying concern with some of these proposals, particularly the ones that we were focused on in Florida. And I think at the end of the day, there was a concern that that longstanding ethical imperative had not outlived its justification and that we could not be confident that these structural reforms that were presented to us would not undermine that ethical imperative in the legal profession. Now, the second concern that I think led us to not move forward with the reforms that were presented to us goes back to the impetus for our initial examination of the potential reform measures, the reason we went down this path to look at all these things. And that is that our desire to improve access to legal services, particularly for low and moderate income people. I mean, that was the problem we were trying to address. And we wanted to examine ways that we could do that. And that's what we were focused on. And so when we received the proposals, they were rejected partly based on a lack of what we felt at the time was any convincing demonstration that the reforms related to the ownership of legal practices and fee sharing would in fact improve access to legal services for low and moderate income people. There was no confidence that the medicine prescribed would in fact cure or ameliorate the ailment for which it was prescribed. Now, again, I understand that, as I said before, that sometimes you can't know if it's going to work until you try it. But again, we're hoping that we're going to learn from these other experiences. And of course, you know, some of these reforms have been tried for some period of time in other places in the world, in Australia and in Great Britain. And I don't think we saw that they were having the kind of impacts there in those jurisdictions, these sorts of structural reforms, that we were having the kind of impact on access that we were looking for. Now, maybe there's more information. Maybe we'll learn more about that. Maybe we missed something. But that was not presented to us in a way that we felt was convincing. On our court, I was Chief Justice for 6 years and issued administrative order after administrative order, and we went through the pandemic and with the raft of changes from week to week. But I think it at that time it was certainly true, but in every time, everything we do is a work in progress. Okay, nothing is really final. I mean, cases become final, but as far as our administrative work and our policymaking work, it goes on. And so I don't think that anything we have done so far precludes us from looking at reforms as we go forward and learn more about the potential for benefit to the people we are there to serve. And again, our focus is, I believe that I could speak for my colleagues in saying this, our focus is on serving the people of the state of Florida. That's why the courts are there, and that's why the legal profession is there. We are there to provide this important these important services to the people of Florida. We want to do better at it. We are committed to doing that, but we want to take steps to accomplish that will not have unintended consequences that will actually cause harm to the people we are there to serve and the people who have entrusted to us the responsibility for regulate to us as the Supreme Court of Florida for regulating the admission of lawyers to the practice of law and their discipline. Now, on the, I will say this: we haven't really examined the aspect of the reforms that have been talked about earlier related to the admission of lawyers. Although we did look at that, that was brought to our attention during the pandemic when we were having trouble figuring out how to administer the bar exam in the traditional way. We worked our way through that with some hiccups, but we ultimately worked it out. But there was a big push at that point to basically do away with the bar exam and to move to some sort of apprenticeship model of some sort. And I think some people saw that as the opportunity to kind of put an end to the bar exam. Now, I'm with Clint on this. I'm personally, I'm very reluctant to do away with the bar exam. Partly that comes from my work as a regular in the disciplinary process and seeing, you know, we got problems now. And of course, in a state with more than 100,000 lawyers, there are going to be a certain number of people who are not doing what they're supposed to be doing. But there's some people that seem to get through even meeting the requirements that we established that aren't quite really up to it. I mean, and sometimes that might not be because they actually lack the ability or knowledge. It's because of other problems that have come up and that are affecting them. So I think that, but we were, quite reluctant to do anything then that would move us away from the use of the bar exam. And I speak for myself, and I probably shouldn't say this, but if I were going to do anything, if I had to choose between eliminating the requirement to go to law school and eliminating the requirement to go to take the bar exam, it would not be eliminating the requirement to take the bar exam. Okay? Okay? And that may be consistent with something Clint said, too, about what was not being taught in law school. We've given, under the Florida Constitution, we're given that responsibility. I question whether we could just deregulate, given what our Constitution gives us as a responsibility to take on that responsibility of regulating admission and discipline. I'm not sure that it really fit with the constitutional mandate to regulate by not regulating. So that's where we are in Florida. But we do not have a closed mind. Certainly, I don't have a closed mind. I want to continue to work on these problems, and I'm hoping we will learn some things, and maybe some of our concerns about potential unintended consequences will be alleviated as time goes forward. Because this is, as I said, a work in progress, and we always need to be striving to do the best we can in the way we structure things to serve the people that all these institutions exist to serve.
Thank you, Justice Kennedy. Ms. Hirsch?
Ms. Hirsch. Thank you, everyone. And a special thanks to Justice Busby for having me. So again, my name is Danielle Hirsch. I'm with the National Center for State Courts. The National Center for State Courts is the secretariat of the Conference of Chief Justices and the Conference of State Court Administrators. And I'm here today really to talk about an initiative of the conferences, which is CLEAR, the Committee on Legal Education and Admissions Reform. It is chaired by Chief Justice Gordon McDonald of the New Hampshire Supreme Court, and its vice chair is Justice Bacon from the New Mexico Supreme Court. And among our 12 members include Chief Justice Parker, who's here today. The conferences felt really strongly about looking at the issue of legal admissions reform, and in part because of a couple of headwinds which have been mentioned already today. One, the growing number of legal deserts that are happening across the country. We started to do some interesting mapping. The ABA has done some also, where if you look at the number of counties across the country where there are a very small number of lawyers. Usually one of those lawyers is the judge, one of those lawyers is doing some kind of prosecution, and then if there are any lawyers left over for indigent defense or any kind of representation. The second kind of, I think, undergirding reason for CLEAR comes from the evolving, changing practice of the law, whether that's the growth and use of technology or AI or other things. And then the third, which Justice Kennedy just mentioned, is really the COVID disruption. A lot of courts innovated during the pandemic about the bar passage process, and it forced a larger national look. And then I guess the last one is really that the UBE is changing to next gen, so there's change happening anyway. And this all raises kind of fundamental questions about what the best way is to credential or admit new lawyers. This project is about a year and a half in the making. So as I mentioned, there are nine chief justices and three state court administrators that are involved in providing the overarching leadership of this work. But there are also three working groups with more than 75 people working kind of tirelessly to make recommendations. We've had eight listening conferences with four more to go across the country, asking bar leaders, educators, practitioners, government service providers what their thoughts are on all of this, and more than 100 stakeholder interviews. And I think the CLEAR work falls into three big buckets. The first is the issue of practice readiness. How do we ensure that new lawyers are ready to practice law? And by that means all sorts of different kinds of things, including hanging a shingle, taking appointed counsel cases. There's been a lot of research done about the practice readiness, including from IELTS, which has been mentioned earlier, Carnegie, McCrate Report, where I think CLEAR provides an interesting new way is defining practice readiness into three areas. There's doctrinal skills and knowledge, there are soft skills, and then there are practical skills like how to do interrogatories or how to file documents or how to know what local rules are and how to practice in state courts and to ensure that whatever way we examine young lawyers or credential them, that it satisfies all three areas of practice readiness. And then the second is bar admissions, which has been mentioned before, and there are two ways really to think about this. You can, when you admit, so some places admit during law school or after law school, and there are three subcomponents really, I think. There's using an exam, using a non-exam pathway, or a hybrid model. And I just wanted to showcase some of those innovations that have been happening across the country. So as it relates to the exam, there's obviously the uniform bar exam, which 41 states use now, many of whom are transitioning to the next gen bar exam. But then there are jurisdictions like California that are going to go a different way and prepare their own exam. There are the non-exam pathways, the most famous of which is a portfolio process during law school in New Hampshire. New Hampshire has a single law school and has a Daniel Webster Scholars Program, which is an honors program at the law school. It has six intensive skill-based courses in close coordination with the Board of Bar Examiners, and at the end of completing those successfully, those honor students are granted admission to practice law upon graduation. There are other programs that are looking at apprenticeships post-law school, so that's usually in partnership with bar admissions. Those are jurisdictions that have just started rolling those out, like Oregon and Washington State, and South Dakota will be announcing that later this year. And then there are the hybrid models, like Justice Bollock mentioned in Arizona, where you are taking the exam, and then depending on your cut score, you can then work in public interest or rural practice, kind of solving for some of this. Or Nevada, who's going to be offering the exam during the life of law school, and then some apprenticeship afterwards. And then the last big bucket that CLEAR is looking at, which I think is part of the reason for all of this, going back to the legal deserts, is how to promote lawyers working in the public interest. And by public interest, the CLEAR committee has taken a really broad view that includes both prosecutors and people providing indigent defense and government lawyers, but also small and solo practitioners who are taking appointed counsel cases or serving in people law. And how do we make sure we encourage lawyers to do that? And there have been some enormous bright spots in innovating in that space as well that I wanted to mention. For example, South Dakota and New Mexico have rural practice incubator programs that usually provide some kind of stipend or loan forgiveness to encourage new lawyers to practice in rural communities. and have a real mentorship component with existing lawyers in those places. And hopefully they hold promise for ways to address legal deserts going forward. And then the other, which is relatively new, is allowing for graduates of online legal education providers to sit for state exams. So California has been doing this notably for a while, but Indiana just promulgated rules to allow online legal education, keep graduates of online legal education providers to apply for and then sit for the Indiana bar exam, with the idea that people who live in rural communities are far more likely to then practice in their home communities than they are to move their families to wherever the law school is located and then move back. So anyway, those are just some of the examples of the issues that the CLEAR working group is looking at. Another one which the committee will have to grapple with is portability, especially among these other pathways. What does it mean if you take a non-exam based pathway, and how does that work in other places? All of this work is going to be wrapped up by July of 2025, and so we have a lot of work to do, but really happy to be here.
Thank you, Ms. Hirsch. We've got about 30 minutes left, and I want to be sure we have a chance for some questions and dialogue among the panel and then to hear your questions as well. So let me start with a question to each of the panelists, and then we can have a little more discussion up here if there's time, and then we'll leave about 15 minutes for audience questions. First, Ms. Ricca, Justice Kennedy mentioned the dictum of first do no harm, and you've given us some statistics about the harm that's out there in terms of people not being able to get representation, and shared that with us already, and I think the consequences of being unrepresented, there's obvious harm that flows from that. But it is a question about, will there be unintended consequences from some of these reforms? And I know in Utah, and Justice Bullock can share with us in Arizona, there's a track record now for seeing how are these reforms going to work to increase access? Are there unintended consequences that flow from them? So I wonder if you might tell us about the current state of affairs in Utah as you understand it. And in particular, we were particularly struck in Texas about the very high satisfaction rate that has been, people have been surveyed who've used these providers, and the survey rates have been extraordinary in terms, from what I understand, of satisfaction with the products.
Sure. So I can speak to the Utah sandbox, and I believe that the story is quite similar in Arizona. The Utah model is, as I said, it's kind of a pilot, but it allows for a lot of diversification and innovation within the sandbox, because the idea was to open things up as much as possible and allow folks who want to innovate and want to think differently about providing legal services to do so. And the regulatory model that has been developed is one that moves the focus from these front end sort of restrictions that we have to a back end kind of data responsive regulatory framework. So very few sort of rules on the front end for how you have to structure your business, how you have to train or educate non-lawyers or train the software that you want to use, because the court in its humility recognized that perhaps others might know better how to train AI-based software and whatnot. But on the back end, once you're authorized in the sandbox, you have to report really detailed data to the Office of Legal Services Innovation. It depends on sort of your risk level, but it's a risk-based model, but for most entities, it's every month. They're reporting line service level data. So, you know, a will, that would be one service, but there's more services per consumer. So higher number of services, lower number of consumers. But they have to report this detailed level of data every month in the sandbox. And so it's really remarkable because it's the first time this has happened in the context of legal services provision outside of kind of a legal aid context. Legal aids often have to report quite detailed data for their funding grants. But so we get a really interesting insight into what's happening every day. The court gets a much more detailed private report, but a lot of this information is produced public. So right now, I looked at the most recent report, make sure I was up to date. There are 43 entities in the sandbox, and over 100,000, it's actually 108,000 services have been provided to more than 24,000 differentiated consumers. Utah's a small state, so there's, I think, 8,000 lawyers in the bar. And what's really interesting about that is almost 20,000 of those services were provided by non-lawyers, whether software or in person. And so the areas of service are business, small business services, immigration, military benefits, criminal expungement. Those are the kind of top tier numbers. And while I can't necessarily speak as much to consumer satisfaction, from the regulator standpoint, what the regulator looks for is whether, and we collect complaint data and also across a number of the other metrics that the office collects, we look for consumer harm. And the model is set up that way, so that regardless of who's providing the service or what's providing the service on the front end, the back end metrics are oriented toward identifying whether consumers are being harmed by any of the services provided. So obviously complaints are the most explicit indicator of that. We know that complaints can come in for a lot of different reasons, but there's sort of a rubric to identify whether the complaints are actually about legal services harm, you know, whether they got a poor legal service, whether they're being upsold. Very few complaints. I think the most recent data, I believe, was 18 complaints across the board. And a subset of those was identified as consumer harm. I think at last look, it was 11. But I don't hold that. That's given the number of services provided and the number of consumers being helped, that's quite a small number. And I believe that in Arizona, it's similar in terms of.
Yes. Yeah.
So far, as the data that's coming in from both Arizona and Utah, we're not seeing sort of a drastic increase in consumer harm. We can't prove the negative, but we can do as much as we can to try and pull data from these organizations and pull data from the public through complaints, to be more proactive about soliciting complaints. As you all know, complaints about lawyers, you don't have a very good data at all. And so we're trying to be better than that in terms of a system on the back end that actually sources and responds to empirical information on consumer harm. And so far, the story, I think, is a good one in terms of that.
That's really helpful, and fewer than 10 complaints on over 100,000 services is pretty remarkable. I would think that's probably higher than lawyer satisfaction. But it is an interesting statistic. And Justice Bullock, I'd be interested in your perspective in Arizona as well on how well is this working, and are you seeing unintended consequences of potential harm? And the other thing I just wanted to mention, and maybe you can comment on this, to sort of give a concrete example of what are these non-lawyer-owned entities doing. I know that one that's licensed in both Utah and Arizona is the RASA legal app, which can you can go online and fill out your information to get your criminal record expunged if you qualify for that. And then a paraprofessional can download that data, as I understand it, file it with the court, prove it up, for a flat fee. And so that's one example of the innovation that, and you may have others you'd like to share.
Yeah. So, it's really, in my opinion, it's really going well. And, Ms. Ricca is probably more familiar with the statistics in my state than I am. And I'm really glad that there's multiple entities looking, at this. But what we have seen, especially to respond to Justice Kennedy's point about access to legal services, probably the best innovation in that regard is providers of legal forms who are now also providing ancillary legal services. And that, I think, will have the biggest impact on access to justice. The principal consumer benefit, though, is one-stop shopping. And all of these models that have been presented to us through ABSs, they have perceived a need in the market and a market for combined services of some sort. And I mentioned the patent one as an example, but they're just things that we never would have imagined. And instead of having a lawyer to represent you in one discrete area and then having to get related services, you can do it all at once. And I get most of my medical services at Mayo. Anyone who's had that experience where the doctors all talk to each other, you know, and give you physical therapy or whatever related services you need, you know, that's what I hope that we will continue to see. The one identified unintended consequence, I guess, to use that term, that others have identified is that Arizona has become a favorite organizational situs for third-party litigation funding. And this has alarmed business groups who don't like this, and I get that they don't like it. I actually just finished chairing a task force on the special ethics concerns that attend third-party litigation funding. Ironically, even though they are organizing and taking advantage of the ABS model, they are not litigating in Arizona, and the reason, I think, is because we are not a particularly friendly place to mass tort litigation. We take a very traditional approach to the concept of duty. So they're organizing in Arizona and litigating in federal courts or in state courts. But this was a great concern. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has identified this as an issue. They were represented on our task force. I don't see it as it certainly wasn't something that I would have predicted, but I don't see it as a negative at all. And in fact, their entire definition, whether you like what they do or not, is to provide services, access to legal services for people. So if you're going to have a market system just in the school choice context where the exact same arguments were presented against school choice, first do no harm, the sky is going to fall, yeah, it's a bad system, but it will only get worse. The same the same thing is happening in this context, and I'm knocking on what I think is wood when I say so far so good.
Thanks for that. And that's an interesting point. I'd actually like to get Justice Kennedy's thoughts on this, too, on litigation finance, because we heard some of the same concerns. We also have a task force that looked at the issue, although we haven't acted on it yet, taken any action yet in the area of the non-lawyer ownership. But one of the concerns that we heard there was very similar to the one that you heard, Justice Kennedy, in terms of financial arrangements where the profit motive could erode the independent judgment of lawyers. One of the interesting responses we heard to that was, well, you allow third-party litigation financing, and you allow insurance companies to represent their policyholders. And so we have ethical rules in place, certainly, and they've been tried and true for a long time in Texas, for sure, and I imagine in most other states, about how do you manage that conflict in the insurance context where somebody's paying the bill, but your interests are not necessarily aligned. And there are ethical rules that Utah and Arizona, I know, have put in place to try to deal with that in a similar way. But the other point was, if you're allowing third-party litigation financing, aren't the same incentives there if you're financing it with equity rather than debt? You know, you would still think that the financier, whether they're loaning you the money or investing, you know, might have an incentive that you would want to discourage to be able to control the specific conduct of litigation. and at least Utah and Arizona have come up with some methods that they're trying to prevent that. So I didn't know if you had heard similar concerns about litigation financing.
That is definitely an issue that is adjacent to these issues. I mean, it's about how the profit motive can interfere with the duty to the client. And that's what it comes down to. If the imperative to make money and to keep the client from being served the way the client should be served. Now, on third party litigation financing, there's the access side to that too. Just like on these other issues, if it helps with access, that's a plus. But you've got to be concerned about how that's gonna. It may give access, but then it may actually be more access for people to make money than it is for the client's actual interest to be served. So, and of course, in that arena, there's also the one kind of interim sort of measure, or it's to have more transparency about, and that's an approach that's been taken. Again, that's not something we have thoroughly examined, I know our legislature actually was looking at some things on that, which did not go forward. But I'm sure there's going to be more and more on that, and we'll stay tuned.
Great, thank you, Ms. Hirsch. I know Justice Mitchell would have wanted to mention, if he were here, the Harvesting Hope initiative that they have in Alabama, which is. It falls into one of the buckets that you mentioned about stipend and loan forgiveness to encourage rural practice. And so that's one that Alabama is trying, and I wanted to be sure that we mentioned that since Justice Mitchell wasn't able to be here. And I appreciate your describing the work, and it's a huge body of work, and it's going to be helpful to all of us, I know. One of the things that was discussed when we had the listening in session in Texas that you might mention is that some states are at least discussing, I don't know if anybody has implemented this yet, do you really need to have 3 years of law school if you're going to be willing to practice in a rural area or an underserved practice area in an urban area? Or might you, only need to go to a few semesters of law school and thereby reduce the debt that you have to pay off and then complete the rest of your time in an apprenticeship or something like that? So would you mind commenting on that briefly and what y'all are hearing on that?
Yeah, we've been hearing kind of consistently at listening conferences just that. Is 3 years of law school necessary? Is the third year of law school, should that be more of an apprenticeship? Should it depend on the track that you're choosing? We heard one lawyer who was a supervisor and hired at a large law firm in Albuquerque, and he said, if you take the name tag off and you don't know if somebody is a 2L or a 3L, their skills are often very similar. Why are we making people incur that much more debt? So I don't know of any jurisdiction or any law school who's outright gotten rid of the third year of law school yet, but it is a repeated theme we're hearing over and over across the country.
Great. Well, thanks for sharing that. And let me ask if there's anything anybody else on the panel wants to share, just by way of a brief closing comment, please do, and then we'll get questions from our audience.
Just one point, and that was what you raised. I am a passionate believer in federalism, but with federalism comes a lack of portability, and that is going to be a very, very difficult thing to overcome. So I'm really anxious to see if we can find a common denominator that will allow for what has to happen in the law, and that is unsegmenting our geographically unsegmenting the practice of law to the maximum extent possible.
All right, well, let's go to the microphone and invite some comments. And if you'll just state your name and affiliation and then ask your question.
Coach Winehouse, I run Judiciocracy. We're the largest publisher of judicial misconduct news and attorney misconduct news in the country. The gist of the question is, how important is a lawyer's oath for a lawyer to take? And because it does lead to a systemic issue. Illinois is probably the best example. We have a convicted felon ex-alderman who cannot be disbarred because the judges who would otherwise rule in his disbarment take their judicial oath of removing conflicts of interest. They take it very seriously, so they couldn't convene a quorum. and we have a lawyer who maybe wouldn't otherwise be a lawyer. But we take oaths very seriously as attorneys. We invest in our education, our license, our profession. The same judiciary has brought bar complaints against me for what my publications have done, including, I think, Ms. Hirsch's ex-boss. But this is a systemic issue. We have the judges doing these things, and that's great. But lawyers, we take it seriously. What I think we're talking about, and Justice Kennedy makes it very clear, is there are reforms you can make that do not require lowering the lawyer's commitment through years of education and massive amounts of debt, a bar exam, or an apprenticeship if through an alternative matter, such as Zoom access to courts, as he mentioned, removing the requirement for stenographers and using technology for that. So I work on both issues. I think what I'm most concerned about, and I'd like your take on it, is by introducing the capitalist element, whether through funding, debt, or equity, you end up with people who are theoretically zealously advocating for their client who can simply exit the system without the proof of work, without the investment into their oath that the lawyers have taken. And if that's going to affect people in a systemic way for the system where they won't be as zealous advocates, say, or captured by their adversaries, or, as in the case of Illinois, potentially captured by the system?
Well, I think it's an important question, and I think we need all of those reforms because the scale of the problem is so vast that no one reform is going to solve it, right? When you're talking about 90% of low-income people in this country who can't get help with their basic civil legal problems, we need it all. No one solution is going to fix this. So we do absolutely need forms, and we're doing some of the same things that Justice Kennedy was talking about in Texas, but it's a drop in the bucket. And, you know, then you're still relying on the individual uneducated in the law, self-represented person to be able to correctly fill out those forms. And I would love to connect you with some of my judges to talk about the terrible problems that they have with people actually being able to fill those out correctly. So I think we need it all. And I think we already have third-party debt financing in most of the states in this country. And I actually think some of the reforms that have been discussed in Utah and Arizona help strengthen the ethical requirements there so that there isn't influence between the financing and the actual people who are providing the legal services under their oath and whose loyalty is to their clients. So I think in some ways that's a better situation than we have now, where there aren't rigid ethical rules about how can a third-party litigation funder influence the provision of the legal services. So that's one way to look at it, but there's also, obviously lawyers educate themselves and take their oaths very seriously, and we've got to rely on that. But there has to be a way to solve this problem at the same time without expecting lawyers to do it all. I mean, we could have we could mandate pro bono for every Texas lawyer that they do 100 hours a year, and it wouldn't solve this problem. We don't have enough lawyers to solve the problem. And so the question is, what do you do for the people that lawyers are not serving? And that's a big part of this population.
Just to add to that, in each of the reforms that we've undertaken, a really great question, ensuring that legal ethics are maintained is our paramount goal. And that's like the first issue that we deal with. And I'm happy to say that in the alternative business structure context in Arizona, that there is now an emergence of legal specialists who specialize in providing advice to alternative business structures. And that requires training a non-legal organization or an organization that has non-legal components about legal ethics and communications and all of those things. I had to do that when we opened the litigation center at the Goldwater Institute. I remember having a conversation with my boss telling her, you can't tell me how to practice law, even if you're paying for it, right? So this is, and the task force that we just completed on third-party litigation funding, which, by the way, is happening regardless of these legal reforms, is to create transparency mechanisms that will allow judges to, first of all, know that this is happening, and second of all, let the other parties know that it's happening so that the ethics can be policed.
Thank you. Next question.
Good afternoon, distinguished panel. My name is Chris Kenny, and I own six supermarkets in Delaware and have 1,000-plus union associates and approximately 100,000 customers a week. And we service the exact clientele that we're discussing at this point from both the employment and a customer perspective. And I can tell you, I did not expect to walk through this door and be frightened further that my business model will be insolvent in the near future if these reforms go through. So I'm glad when I stood up to come and speak the last few moments that Justice Bullock, you referred to, there was at least some semblance of a reaction at this point from the business community. But I can assure you from my own personal experience, having been the CEO for the last 12 years of our family business and been in the family business for the last 30 years, that the acceleration in the level of frivolous and fraudulent legal actions will be at a scale of enormous proportions. We are already facing incredible pressures on the cost from a production standpoint and a transportation standpoint and a manufacturing, you name it. We're paying $4.29 for a dozen eggs. That's what I'm paying. And we're part of a $16 billion a year cooperative. $4.29 cost. So when you layer in the level of acceleration in potential legal actions from the workers' comp perspective or from the slip and fall perspective or from the EEOC perspective or the ADA, the laundry list of forms to fill out from people that don't have access to quality legal advice is just going to fundamentally alter that particular cost landscape. And we can talk about insurance and deductibles, and we can talk about tort reform, but that is not always a method of ameliorating these costs. There's time, treasure, and talent that has to be deployed against that. And if you're just going to continue to consolidate to the large multinational organizations that can afford this, then you're going to be putting us all out of business, the small mom and pops. So thank you. I don't know, you know, hopefully you could continue to work through the small business organizations within Arizona and elsewhere and really see what is the ramifications. Because I agree with the other distinguished panelists. We need to see if the proof is in the pudding here.
I would just like to invite you to open a store and a legal clinic in Arizona.
Yeah, and also, I mean, I think these problems, the third-party litigation funding, I just looked to see if it's allowable in Delaware, and it looks like it is. And that way predates any of this. So, that opportunity has been out there for people in Delaware, you know, previously. And I would say to be encouraged, because if you're actually providing representation for people, whether by a paraprofessional in a very small claim case, or in one of these alternative business structures, if you're in one of these other states, there are rigid ethical rules in there that require them to only advance meritorious litigation, just like a lawyer would. So that is built in.
Okay,
next question.
Joe Cosby from D.C., particularly for Ms. Ritchie and Justice Bullock. Can you tell us the top four or five metrics that you use to judge the success or failure of these programs? And in particular, we heard about client satisfaction and client complaints and a few other things. Are there specific measurements that you're using to measure the objective quality of the services in addition to the subjective response and satisfaction with them?
Sure. So So at least in the Utah context, the model is a regulatory one. So the concern is really to ensure that consumers are, that there's sort of a floor, right? So that, that consumers are not more harmed than they would be otherwise, which generally, if we look at the numbers, most people are not able to access lawyers. So for most folks, the idea would be that they're trying to help themselves. This is the first time this has been attempted, the model in Utah, in terms of actually trying to understand and evaluate whether consumers are being harmed, because that's not what we have in the lawyer system, right? In the lawyer system, we've got ethical rules. They're sort of proxies for consumer harm. And we don't actually ask. We don't actually have any idea. We see disciplinary, but that's for violation of rules. It's not for consumer harm. So that's the first metric. We have these kind of aspects of service, like how long did the service take? How much were they charged? What did they ask for and what did they receive? And of course, these are, it's sort of learning more about how these services are provided and then trying to understand, okay, is there a norm that we can see developing here? Is this falling outside the norm within the company across a particular legal service area? So it's sort of being developed as it's rolled out, because again, this has never been done before. In addition, for some of the higher risk entities, which are entities that are it's entities that are using non-lawyers. For example, RASA. So, this is really interesting. So, a lot of these organizations, the models that they're kind of gravitating for, are sort of tiered level of services, right? So you have one organization, and they have a document like an online component, a technology component that's sort of like for the simple legal issues. And then you can be bumped up to a non-lawyer provider working within the organization. And then, again, if your problem is particularly complex or if you want to, you can seek out a lawyer provider. So for those types of organizations, the Utah Supreme Court requires the entities to undergo audits. And again, it's a process that we developed. It's not really done anywhere else. It's something that we think hopefully could be really useful, particularly as AI becomes more deployed across these organizations. But in those audits, you have two independent Utah lawyers who the company sort of redacts the files, and they review the files and sort of give their input on a kind of 5-point rating scale. Our concern there, again, is like, is this falling below the floor? Not is this kind of the best service that Justice Busby would have provided if he was the client's lawyer? So it's kind of this two-tier approach, but it seems to be working so far. And we're adjusting as we go.
And in Arizona, there's an annual renewal process, and the entities have entity-specific metrics that they have to demonstrate. So they were the metrics that were developed for the initial application to be approved, and then for their renewal as well. And because this is so new, we're not seeing what the fruit of that will be. But we actually are already thinking that for certain entities that have gone through the application process and the renewal process a couple of times, we may want to lighten that burden because it's expensive for them to do this. So all I can so because they are entity specific metrics, they probably will not be generalized. But I have to mention, or I have to say, this structure is far more regulated than normal legal practice. So I think having this extra layer of scrutiny in the beginning will ensure that these organizations do good as well as doing well.
Great, thank you. I know we need to let you all go in a moment for the luncheon, but I want to see if we can answer Chief Justice Parker and Justice Anderson's questions briefly. Chief?
Yes, Tom Parker from Alabama, and I have a structural question about paraprofessionals. Clint, it might be directed to you, but Lucy might have some response too based on Utah. Did you have to create a new entity to perform the testing and the oversight? And how is this financed for the new entity with the extra personnel needed and the time involved in all these processes?
Yes, and one of the things that is peculiar to Arizona is we issue the rules and we say something like, and by the way, you need to have the exams done and the requirements done in 3 months so that we can begin applying these things. So this was a very, very fast rollout. They are financed by the dues that the individuals are paying. So it's a self-financed entity. And the specializations, we now have a number of them in different areas, from criminal misdemeanors to family law, which is the most crying need, to even administrative proceedings. So there's a distinct examination for each and every one, and so we did have to create a new entity within the court to deal with that, but it is financially self-sufficient. Yes. Oh, yes, yes.
And I'll just say, in Texas, where our Board of Law Examiners is helping to do the exam so that we didn't have to create a different entity, and the state bar is going to be doing the ethics over and that sort of thing, just like for lawyers.
Same.
Yeah, and I believe Utah is also bar. I wasn't involved with that program, but I believe bar.
Justice Anderson.
Yes, very quickly, Barry Anderson, retired Minnesota Supreme Court Justice, who's actually... our court has actually been working on the same issues that this panel has expertly discussed today. I'm wondering very quickly if you have any information or documents or data on the effectiveness of independently licensed paralegals. Washington had that program for a while, abandoned it. We have found in Minnesota that the best use of paralegals to deal with the underserved problem is to link those individuals with existing service organizations, meaning regional legal services and other operations, and that doing it independently or even independently with law firms, we really haven't had a great response. And as I said, I think it was Washington that, I mean, I think the program just collapsed.
Yeah, and in Washington, the state bar, from what I have been told, was dead set against the success of that program and really help bring about its demise. So we have fewer than 100 licensed so far, so we're not seeing much data yet. But the training capacity, the University of Arizona set up a training program for them. I think it's going to work out. I would predict within 5 years we'll have 1,000 and we'll be able to see how this is going. But the one thing that really gratified me, and I alluded to this in my comments, was that our Department of Child Services said, we need this. We have very simple legal proceedings that could easily be handled by specialized legal paraprofessionals, and we cannot hire the lawyers to fill that. And if there's one agency where you do not want to have a backlog, it's Department of Child Services. And when they came to us and said, you know, we like what we're seeing, we need a specialized paraprofessional capacity, we immediately responded to that.
Yeah, I would just say that these programs are so new. And so I just wrote down, there's 75 in Washington, 32 in Utah, 65 in Arizona, 62 in Colorado. Really new, right? The best, and I'd be happy to send this to you, but the best research on this comes out of Ontario. Had independently licensed paraprofessionals for a long time. I think they have over 2,000 licensed there. And for the most part, the impact, I believe, it's been a while since I've looked, but the impact is in that middle income bracket. But a lot of very good consumer satisfaction, very positive overall, but it's not necessarily targeted at indigent folks. It's in that middle class bracket because they are charging.
Great, thank you. We need to end it there because we've got to get you all to the luncheon, but we're happy to answer more questions if you have them, and please help me thank our panel.